On Cinema Smorgasbord Sells Out, we'll be looking at contemporary and historical films that have recently slid into the zeitgeist, and we'll be sharing our controversial thoughts and off-the-wall opinions. On this episode, we'll be discussing Denis Villeneuve's massive 2024 Frank Herbert adaptation, Dune Part 2. Welcome to Cinema Smorgasbord Sells Out, the podcast about movies you've actually heard of. I'm Doug Tilley, and with me, as usual, is the usul to my muad'Dib, Liam O'Donnell. How are you doing today, Liam?
Oh, I'm great, Doug. I just got off the Shai Hulud. I just got off, and I'm from the siege. I just came in, and my eyes are blue, and I smell like cinnamon. I'm cinnamony. It's great.
I feel like we're already alienating the people that we're trying to draw in with a more mainstream fucking podcast, Liam.
I think very soon you will learn, as and the audience will learn, that this supposedly mainstream podcast is going to go down dark tunnels of nerdery that will alienate all but the very dedicated Fremen out there.
It's an interesting point, though, right? Because like Dune, for a very long time, was considered unfilmable, which is odd because there's been not only a film made of it previously, but also a television miniseries, as well as an attempted, as we've talked about at length, Liam, on our other podcast called Jodorowsky, about the life and work of Alejandro Jodorowsky, about the abort attempt back in the 1970s.
Right.
So this is something that people have been trying to kind of nail for years and years, and there's been various, you know, levels of success depending on your perspective on those other properties. But I think that there's a consensus that, you know, at least in terms of the diehards of the books, that the most or the closest that they've ever come is with these Denis Villeneuve movies. Is that something, would you agree with that? Or is that, am I way off with that? Because I have not read the books. I've only read like the first half of the first book.
I would say it's the closest while still being good. I do think there are people who would say, if we're going purely on book accuracy, that the weird TV movie Dune was pretty close, but it was also unwatchable. It was just very bad. And so, I mean, don't get me wrong. I watched it when it happened, and I remember thinking it was pretty okay. But my bar was pretty low for it at the time. And now I think what, I mean, we'll get into how we feel about it, but I do think that it's inarguable that what Villeneuve has pulled off here is at least a very entertaining and engaging version that maybe not all people who are unfamiliar can connect with. I've definitely seen people who went to see it and were still kind of like, wait, what the fuck? You know?
Right.
But I think most people who have a passing understanding of what the story is can follow along to this movie, be fully excited and entertained, and leave, honestly, excited for another one, which I don't know I was expecting at all, that people would actually want a sequel. And I'm seeing a lot of folks who are not diehard fans, who have not read the books, say, oh man, I can't wait for the next movie. And I'm like, really? All right, cool. You know, if that's how you feel.
I mean, that's
cool.
Interesting, right? In some ways, this Dune adaptation is sort of like this podcast, right? It's like taking something that is incredibly nerdy and that has a lot of lore with it and a lot of very specific language. I'm speaking now, Liam, of our other podcasts. And then kind of distilling it in a way that is more palatable, while also, I think, retaining a surprising amount of weirdness. I know that one of the conversations that's been happening over the last few days on social media is, you know, comparisons to the David Lynch movie. And David Lynch is the most beloved person on movie Twitter or movie X or whatever the fuck you would call it these days. Like, just ever, right? And I love David Lynch and I love his work. But because of how beloved he is and how some people take are at odds with the success of Denis Villeneuve and maybe think that his work is a little cold or dispassionate or whatever, that they can't help but compare one very, very negatively, even if they, on a base level, they both recognize the flaws in David Lynch's version and while also seeing the qualities of Denis Villeneuve's version. I want to ask you, now you've talked about this a little bit on Jodorowsky, but I want to make sure that we're approaching this for listeners who haven't heard any of this before. You are a Dune head, right? You've read some Dune in your time.
I have read the first four books, which are all Herbert written. And then he wrote two more books after those four, Heretics of Dune and Chapter House Dune.
Now, when you say Herbert written, you got to be very careful.
Oh, that's true. Frank Herbert written. And then to clarify for folks, because if you look up Dune, there's a bajillion books. There's a whole series of books written by his son, co-written by his son, some of them. And those are, for many Dune fans, those are not canonical. Now, Doug, I have become a bit more Dune-obsessed recently because of the movie. I will say, prior to this, I was more of a medium Dune fan because I'd only read those four books, when there are six to
only four gigantic books.
They're not that big, actually. Dune Messiah is weirdly short, considering how much, you know, some of those books are. A couple of the books are actually a little bit shorter because they kind of go by a little quick. But yes, I have read four books, which sounds like a lot, but... and I think other people who are both nerds and ADHD will understand this. You go through cycles of things that you care about. So like 44-year-old Liam doesn't understand the Liam who used to skank at ska shows. That doesn't make sense to me. That person doesn't exist. But they did exist, Doug.
You mean in 1998?
I'm sorry, Doug. 1996. Let's be clear.
Okay, fair enough.
The point is, that was a part of my life that I no longer identify with, but at that time was very important. Yes, there was a moment where I was really into Dune. I will say, back then, the fourth book turned me off, and that's why I didn't read books five and six, and I wrote them off. And only now that I'm older and weirdly less connected to it, like I care less about it, I can now see that while those last two books are fucking insane, they're kind of they seem kind of fun. I've read about what they're about. They seem kind of silly and fun, and I get that, like, for Frank Herbert, the ideas were more important than the narrative. And I think to some extent he thought the wilder he made the narrative, the more clearly people would focus on the ideas, which is actually the opposite of what happened. You know, like, the wilder he made the narrative, the more people got wrapped up in how crazy the narrative was and kind of lost track of the ideas he was trying to put forth. But the ideas were what mattered to him. And so the other thing I'll say is, the reason I'm back on the Dune ship a little bit is not just the release of this movie, but before the movie was coming out, I reread the first book. And not only did I find that I still enjoyed it, which I was not expecting. I thought maybe I had moved past it. But also, parts of it I understand more now than when I first read it. And that was really revelatory for me. Now, does that mean I'm going to keep going and read the other three that I read before? I don't know, man. I got all this stuff to read. I don't know if I'm going to do that. But I do have a little more respect for it now than I think. Even though I loved it as a kid, over time I kind of got a little, not cynical, but a little bit like, beyond it, I thought, and now I kind of respect it a little more while also seeing its flaws way more now than when I was like a teenager.
I really credit you, Liam, when we were doing our Jodorowsky episode about Dune, to kind of setting me straight on something that I was really off about. It was only my impression, and to be totally honest, part of this impression is reinforced by the David Lynch version, which is that Dune is just a basic hero's journey story, right? And at the end of the David Lynch version, and this is my memory, it's been a little while since I've watched it. I mean, there is not the same suggestion of a Messiah-like character that is potentially in the wrong, if not clearly in the wrong, or at the very least just replacing one despotic leader with another one. In the David Lynch version, it seems like a uncomplicated good that Kyle MacLachlan rises through the ranks. While, you know, I feel like what you were telling me is that in the books, it's made very clear that what's happening to Paul Atreides is kind of fucked up, right? Uh-huh. And that it's a criticism of the single leader who is supposed to bring everyone to salvation.
I think one of the things, Doug, that we'll talk about when we get into the Villeneuve thing, but I think I can sort of preview a little bit here, is that I've come to a new appreciation of Lynch's version in that there are a bunch of things that it kind of gets right. And it's worth noting that Herbert famously said he didn't think the Lynch version was that bad.
In fact,
he defended the first half. He said the first half is not that different than the books. It's only towards the end that it loses track. And obviously, the movie completely misses the point of the book. But he thought that was a minor point. Like, literally, Herbert was like, you know, his Paul is Jesus and my Paul is a deluded teenager. But sure, otherwise, it's pretty good. You know, and
we should know, by the way, that it seems like Jodorowsky's version would also have missed the point.
100%. 100%. And so I think that, like, one of the things people can argue back and forth about the Lynch version versus the Villeneuve version. I think there are various reasons to defend one and be critical of the other. But without giving away a little bit what I think of the Villeneuve one, I think when it comes to the Lynch version, there's insights that it has as to the complicated dynamics and to the pacing. But the ending really shows that either Lynch or probably more likely the producers, right, did not understand the fucking book or didn't care. I think it's probably more likely that they didn't give a fuck what the book's point was, that they just wanted a fucking Star Wars movie, right?
Yeah, they wanted a Star Wars movie.
Absolutely. And so that's, you know, Paul can't be Paul. Paul has to be some version of Luke Skywalker, which is definitely not what that character is meant to be. But I think that, one of the things that I'm kind of surprised at the positive reactions to this new movie is because I think it's a little closer to the original idea. And I think that in my head, I was still operating under the idea that America prefers a hero. But afterwards, someone pointed out that actually for the last 20 years or so, we've been kind of obsessed with anti-heroes. So now I'm wondering if, even if you portray Paul as an anti-hero, people won't get that Herbert didn't like that figure, right? Like,
right,
people
right,
just
right.
be like, oh, he's an anti-hero, it's great, you know, because people fucking worship Tony Soprano, and Tony Soprano sucks. So I think that this might fall into that category. We'll see what happens.
But also, you know, we live in a world of populist leaders as well, right?
Right,
and ones
right,
that, right. And even ones, yeah, well, figureheads and whatnot. So, I mean, we'll get into that when we talk about the movie proper. And I think that you've already given your thoughts on David Lynch's movie to some extent. I don't want to belabor the point. I like that movie a lot. I think maybe Frank Herbert is right in that the first half of that movie is very coherent, mm-hmm. and then the second half feels very rushed, right? And that's please.
I want to say I agree. That's my major criticism. And in fact, the reason I read the book is because I went to see Lynch's version in the theater and left so fucking dissatisfied. Like, God damn it. This movie is not what it should be, even though I think visually speaking, it at times is way more interesting than Villeneuve's
sure,
version.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But it ultimately feels like it fails. I will say, I think the rushed ending was just Lynch having to take what he wanted to be a 3.5 hour movie and turn
absolutely.
It into a 2 hour, mm-hmm. 10 minute movie. But I also think it does reflect a reality in the book, which I was not aware of until I listened to, if people want to find it, there's a really long audio interview on YouTube with Frank Herbert where he basically says the book speeds up, that the beginning of the book is supposed to be very slow and very measured, and that it speeds up and it speeds up and it speeds up until the end. And the end he described as high camp, which like made me so fucking happy, Doug, because I would have previously described the Dune books as overly serious and lacking a sense of humor, but unintentionally funny. And now I know, listening to Herbert talk, it was goddamn intentional and that we just didn't understand. And now I'm kind of stoked to reread the books.
That's interesting because a greased up Sting is a lot more high camp than what we get in the Villeneuve.
I think that's why Herbert didn't hate the movie. I think he still thought it missed the point, and I think he probably understood that it couldn't represent the complexity of the books. I do think he overestimates it a little bit because his expectations are so low. I kind of got the feeling he just was happy it wasn't a fucking disaster, which some people think it is. I don't think it is a disaster. I just think it's not great, and I think it's because I love Lynch that I kind of am frustrated with the movie because it really feels like they did everything they could to suck him out of the movie. You get the Space Girl guys, you get a couple of moments here and there, but a lot of the movie has nothing to do with David Lynch as a creator, I think.
Yeah, it's his least personal film.
Right.
And the touches of Lynchian stuff in there, you know, I think that's what people point to in terms of what they really enjoy about it. I also think that it's a movie that really, when they released it, they had no trust in the audience whatsoever for their ability to just kind of like, oh, I don't know what that word means, but I'll just go along with it because contextually I can figure it out. Like the idea of them giving glossaries and things like that, I think that sets it up as being more confusing than it actually is. But I mean, I don't know. Maybe that's just what audiences needed at that time. But I don't think that's the case. I was alive, Liam. I wasn't that confused when I watched the fucking movie.
I think also they were aping what Herbert actually does in that first book, which he has extensive appendices. And in fact, some of the details in those appendices hint at mysteries that he never directly addresses in the books.
Right.
So like later on, people would go, well, actually in the appendix, he says this, which makes me think this. And I'm like, oh, well, when I was a kid, I thought appendices were boring. So I never read that shit. So I don't know anything about what you're talking about.
Liam, would you agree, and this is my interpretation from what I've been seeing, that there was actually a much higher level of difficulty for Denis Villeneuve in the second part of this story than the first? It seems like a lot of the most iconic stuff happens in the first half. And the second half, you know, it's all really interesting, I'm sure, on the page, but because it's not as diverse, right? It's all, I mean, for basically the first half of the second film, it all takes place on Dune or on Arrakis with the sand and all that, that it could very easily, I mean, I've seen it in some criticism that people have towards this movie, that it does not feel like it speeds up, that it feels very glacially paced because it's all taking place for the most part in one location.
I think that that is a struggle. I think also because the films, because people collaborate on this, the film's design work, whether that's set design, costume design, whatever, it feels a bit one note compared to the ridiculous camp of the Lynch movie. It's one of the strong parts of the Lynch movie is all this variety, none of which is represented in the book, right? This is all created whole cloth to a large extent. And this movie, it's not that it's entirely book accurate in its imagery, but it certainly tries to represent a more restrained sort of palette, color, image-wise, all this stuff. So I think there is a bit of a struggle there that it can feel kind of like it is not as exciting. However, Doug, I think actually the first movie was much harder for him because he's been really open about the idea. He thinks dialogue is overrated. And narrative, also overrated. And I know that a lot of people have said that about him as a criticism. I think it's one of his strengths. I also think dialogue and narrative are over fucking rated. It's why I don't think we should be plumbing literature for movie ideas, because I don't think literature always makes the best movies depending on the literature, you know? And so for me, I think the hardest thing for him was to somehow put all this information in our minds in the first movie while still making it look interesting to some extent. And then in the second movie, he felt like there was a lot less setup. So he could just show us a bunch of really impactful images. And those images would do a lot of the work that he needs to have done instead of him having to worry too much. Because there is a lot of information in the book that this movie does kind of gloss or change a little bit.
Sure.
And we'll get into those changes and why I think some of them work and some of them don't. But I think for him as a filmmaker, he at least felt like this movie was easier and more enjoyable for him than the first movie, where there was a burden to say, how do I bring people in this world without making the whole thing grind to a fucking halt, right?
For those who haven't seen Dune Part 2, by the way, it really does live up to that Part 2 name. It starts literally right at where the first part ends. In fact, I fully expect that that once this hits some sort of home format, we'll see an edit of the whole thing into one really, really long, 6-hour long movie. And it probably would work in that way. I mean, maybe not, because the pacing and the rhythms of this one are meant to be a single film already. But I'd be curious to check that out. Liam, I mean, we were just dancing around a little bit. Did you like the first half, the part one of Villeneuve's Dune?
I liked it. I will say, I still have never seen it in the theater. You know, it came out during the pandemic. I watched it at home. And when it came out in theaters, I didn't anticipate that I was going to care that much, so I didn't go see it. In retrospect, I wish I had, because I feel like it would be much more impressive in an IMAX scenario than it is at home. Yeah. I rewatched a big chunk of it today at home, just while I was doing other stuff, had it on the background. I like it. I think that it's just not as impressive because a lot of the most exciting things happen in the second half, you know?
Interesting.
And I understand, honestly, having reread the book, that when I was a kid, Doug, it took me a while to get through this book. I read the first part of the book a couple of times before I finally had the wherewithal to get through the whole book. And I think that's because there is a slower setup in the beginning, and then the narrative kind of ramps up to really get you excited. And I think that that first movie, it has a lot to do, but I didn't think it was bad either. I felt pretty good about it, and I was excited for this movie to come out. But I think for folks, I've seen folks who dislike the first movie a lot, and that's just not where I'm at. Like, I'm just kind of like, it's mostly enjoyable. I think it mostly works. But I also I don't know why there are a segment of people who feel like the first one entirely succeeds and this one somehow fails. I'm very confused at that take as well. I think both movies are doing a surprisingly good job. And while I don't think that they're perfect films, I think it does a lot more good than it does bad, with a couple of exceptions.
I really liked the first one. I saw it in the theater. I think it was one of the first movies I saw, you know, coming out of the pandemic in the theater. And I really enjoyed it. And I was really kind of delving into Dune at that time anyway. So I was in the mood to see an adaptation like that. I will say that one of the odd things about the two halves is that the first movie feels like an adaptation of Dune. And the second one, I'm sure, does as well. Again, I haven't read the book. But you know how they refer to movies these days as vibe movies, where you just want to live in that world a little bit for a while?
Yeah.
I feel like the second part is much more of a vibe movie. And maybe that also reflects that lack of... I think Villeneuve, in some ways, people really went on him about his dislike of dialogue type thing. But, you know, I mean, the classic idea of a movie is that you should be able to watch it without dialogue and know what's going on from the visuals. And I think that that's one of his strengths, are the use of visuals in that way. But I felt like, you know, he really captured a mood. And I think it's because of that, that when it came to the end of the second part, and I felt the same way as the people that you were talking about, Liam, I'm ready for more movies in this universe, right? Yeah. I'm ready for a continuation. And the odd thing, of course, is you saw at the end of the first one, and this partly was because there was no sequel announced at that point. There were some people who were bummed. They're like, what, I'm only getting half a story here? I might not ever see the second half of it? Well, I mean, now it's funny, right? You get the second half, you get a fairly complete story, and then there are people who are like, well, now I want to see more. Because this is 2024, they'll get more, I'm sure. I'm sure we're going to hear the announcement of another sequel in just a couple of days. Mm-hmm. And then you'll probably also hear the announcement of a TV show and
spin-off. There's already a TV show announced.
There we go, Liam.
I forget what it's called, but it's supposed to be like a history of the Bene Gesserit sort of whatever thing. Oh, gotcha. Which, by the way, has to be based off of the newer stuff as opposed to the older stuff, so I'm already skeptical, even though I think the people behind it, I can trust that they have some insight on how to make it work. The fact that the source material is the material that I don't like makes me a little skeptical of the whole thing.
What a nightmare world we live in, where it's just like, oh, you like this? Oh, you like it, huh? Well, how about if we just shove it down your throat until you fucking hate it? I mean, I heard some people being very skeptical of even a follow-up to this movie, the part two of Dune, because they say that the drop-off in quality between even the second book by Frank Herbert is so high that it couldn't possibly make a good movie. But, I mean,
can I be honest, Doug? Those people are stupid.
Okay.
Oh, the first three books are magic, and people who don't like them didn't understand the first book.
This is those hot takes that I mentioned at the very beginning. I can't speak to it one way or another, but... I am curious to dive in a little bit on Dune 2. So let us take a break. When we return, we're going to talk specifically about Dune Part 2 right after this.
It's okay. I'm here. It's been a while since you've had one of those nightmares. Tell me, what was it about?
It's only fragments. Nothing's clear. You've been fighting the Harkonnens for decades.
Look!
My family's been fighting them for centuries.
Your blood comes from dukes and great houses. Here, we're equal. What we do for the benefit of all.
I'd very much like to be equal to you.
Maybe I'll show you the way.
Paul Atreides unites with Chani and the Fremen while seeking revenge against the conspirators who destroyed his family. It's Dune Part 2 from the year 2024, directed, of course, by Denis Villeneuve, also the director of 2013's Enemy, 2015's Sicario, Arrival, Blade Runner 2049. I think a generally very well-liked filmmaker, also a very productive one. And Blade Runner 2049 is a movie that people... you know, I have mixed feelings about to a certain extent, but I think a lot of those mixed feelings are reflected in the social media in which we spend our time with. But I think it's generally considered an almost impossible victory on his part. Written by Denis Villeneuve and co-written with John Spate, who also wrote 2012's Prometheus, and as well as 2016's Passengers, which no one likes, but was on the blacklist, I think, for years and years. He also wrote Doctor Strange for Marvel and 2017's The Mummy, the start of the Dark Universe. The cast, I'm sure people are very familiar with, including Timothée Chalamet as Paul, Muad'Dib Atreides, Zendaya, Rebecca Ferguson, Josh Brolin, Austin Butler joining in this film, Florence Pugh joining in this film, as well as Christopher Walken, and of course Dave Bautista. Lots of other familiar faces, including Stellan Skarsgård as well. Let's start first, Liam. You've already kind of said how you feel this movie compares to the first half at the very least, but let's just talk kind of generally. What did you think of Dune Part 2?
I very much enjoyed it. I think it helps seeing it in the theater because I think the visuals are pretty striking all throughout. Even though I do wonder about the lack of variety of color in the scenes that aren't in the desert. I think for the desert it makes sense, but all the parts out of the desert, it's a little weird. But overall, I think it's really impressive. I got to see it on 70mm, so it looked beautiful. I will say I'm a little curious about the sound design, because seeing it in 70mm was great, but the sound system at the music box I think is maybe not designed for some of the insane sound work of this movie. So there were a couple parts where I was like, this maybe is like too loud, actually. You know what I mean?
I've heard that elsewhere.
In a way
as well.
That's not very clear, whereas maybe a more modern theater, it could have handled it. But outside of the aesthetics of it, I think it works overall. I think it's hard for someone like me who just read the book, right? To not get distracted comparing. Not because I think the changes are bad. We'll get into that more later, but because they are significant and interesting. And I think, in fact, sometimes the ones that work really well as changes are then also distracting, because I'm wrapping myself up in the meaning of the changes and what the changes will mean for the future if they do make another movie. But that's not essential to this movie. So I feel like it's not good to get distracted with those things, because you need to absorb the movie as it is. And I think overall it works. It is strange that, though I think it the pacing is faster than some people seem to think, I think it is a little weird that it does feel at times a little slower than you would think, considering they've moved the timeline up by an unbelievable amount. In the book, it's years, right? And in this movie, it's like, I don't know, what's it been, like a week? You can't tell how long it's even been.
Yeah, It feels like a very short amount of time, certainly.
And I think that overall, just on an enjoyment level, I had fun with it and I thought it was well done. I appreciated the performances. I worried for a while that Christopher Walken was miscast.
Mm.
There is one moment, though, that makes me think, no, it was worth it, when he tries to threaten Paul.
Yeah, yeah.
The way he delivers the line is so Christopher Walken that I thought, he's good just for that part. Because the idea, he's so uptight as the Emperor the whole movie. Mm-hmm, and then just in one moment, he's like, I'll fucking kill you. You're like, oh, okay, there he is. There's Christopher Walken. I see it. And I think that's how the Emperor would be. So like that really worked for me. But overall, I thought the performances were pretty strong. Some of the characterizations are part of the change. So that was interesting for me. And we'll get into those details maybe a little bit here. But I think overall, I think it's pretty solid. It works. I think that I still have some concerns about it, but I think overall I had a good time.
I have a question for you, Liam, which is, do you think Denis Villeneuve understands the source material? And I only ask that because I don't think it's a prerequisite, right, for someone adapting a book, for them to understand. What I should say is understanding might even not even be important, because maybe they're making a different story. In this case, it looks like he's really interested in adapting this book, semi-accurately, and to try to get some of the themes of that book into the movie. Do you think he understands it in a way that, say, Zack Snyder didn't seem to understand the themes of Watchmen?
Oh, 100%. I don't know that all the changes, or even the ways he doesn't change it, are effective in all the places I would want it to be. And again, I understand that that concern might be frustrating for people who really loved this movie. And I overall very much enjoyed it. But I think it's important to remember, for me at least, that if the goal is some sort of faithfulness, that for Herbert, the ideas were more important than the narrative.
Right.
That he didn't really care about the story he was telling, other than the way that the story illustrated what he thought were very important ideas. I mean, Doug, the inspiration for this book, funny enough, was an article he was going to write about scientists controlling sand dunes.
Right.
That's what he started doing research on the ways that you could control sand dunes, because in a sense, deserts are like an ocean. The sand dunes actually do move. And he thought that was interesting, and how scientists were adjusting to that reality so that sand dunes and different parts of deserts didn't destroy man-made things. That's where the inspiration for the fucking book started, and then it became this whole other thing. And I think that that's really demonstrative of the way his mind was working and what he was concerned about. And so knowing that what's more important to him is those ideas, I can see that Villeneuve, I think, was trying to get that across while still making a very engaging movie, because the reality is your film audience is still going to care about the characters and it's going to care about the story, and you can't just abandon those things for the ideas. And I'm not saying that Herbert does, but I think that that could be a temptation when you realize that one of the ideas that Herbert has is plans upon plans. You know, schemes within schemes. And this movie has half of the schemes from the book. Not even half. It has a third of the schemes. And I think that that's, in the nature of making a movie, positive. You're going to bog down your fucking movie with all the schemes. Too many schemes. On the other hand, without some of the schemes, can you still get at all of the themes? And again, I'm not saying it doesn't, but I am interested to see if over time I end up thinking, yeah, they lost something in some of the changes they made.
Right. Though, of course, they have opportunities maybe to bring some of those up in any follow-up material. I haven't really talked about my own thoughts on...
Oh, yeah. Go ahead, Doug. Sorry.
No, you didn't interrupt it. It's because I'm still tangling with them a little bit. And I really did like the first film a lot, but it also felt much more familiar than the material in the second film, because my experience with it has almost solely been with the David Lynch movie, even in various versions of the David Lynch movie. So I didn't know as much what to expect out of the second half outside of, you know, the confrontation between Paul Atreides and the Austin Butler character and the yeah. sandworms and things like that. So, you know, some of it was, you know, a surprise to me. And while I said already that, you know, visually, I don't think this one has as much variety as the first film, the fact that despite Villeneuve's view of dialogue, that I think that the relationships between the characters are a lot more interesting in some
yeah.
ways.
Yeah.
I think it's what draws you in. And I think I've mentioned already that some people have said that the pacing of the second film, they didn't enjoy it that much. I thought the 3 hours pretty much flew by. I agree. You know, there were dips, certainly, but for the most part, we joke all the time about a movie, you know, a movie's length being what it should be to support that material. This felt like the 3 hours is what this story needed. And it also, it just shows you all the more that David Lynch needed a lot more time if he wanted to tell the story that he seemed to want to tell in that movie. So I really enjoyed both parts. I think I still lean a little towards the first because of the newness of the experience. But what I will say as a complete work in terms of like both parts, the thing I like most about Denis Villeneuve as a kind of big budget blockbuster director is the physicality he brings to the use of special effects and the yeah. use, right? He brings a world to life and it doesn't feel like, you know, there's lots of sandstorms and things like the things that traditionally have looked really rocky on film when brought to life through CG. And he really handles these things really, really well. And then there's also his ability to take really slow moments, like the Harkonnens. They have that armor that they can float, and them just floating one after the other. That felt like almost like a Mobius inspired moment, the visuals yep. of it. And yep. honestly, I'll tell you, whatever you, I know some people get on us a little bit about Jodorowsky's Dune and whether it would be a good movie, as if that's important enough. But I will tell you one thing, him bringing on H.R. Giger to do the Harkonnen stuff, every filmmaker since has been like, yep. That is how you're supposed to do it. Giger is the perfect matchup, and I like that you still see those influences on the visuals for the Harkonnen planet here. And I did like the black and white visuals for that, but I will say that the fact that you do go from, you know, those oranges and yellows of the desert to black and white, it's like there's only three colors for this entire movie is this orange, yellow, black, white. But no, I really did have a good time with them, and I have to say, I was consistently impressed by the performances in this movie outside of Christopher Walken. And I'm with you at that moment that you talked about, but he does just kind of seem confused sometimes. And his, maybe it's just the fact that he is Christopher Walken that can be a little distracting sometimes, but also he's just, because in the context of these two movies, we just have not seen him up to this point. Mm-hmm. You don't get the sense that he ever had the kind of charisma or connection with people that could make people see him as the emperor of the entire universe. And maybe he just needed one strong moment, but he just has kind of a sense of weakness about him that's also exemplified from the fact that Christopher Walken is getting older and he's looking a little frailer than we're probably used to him seeing. But I mean, I didn't find it overly distracting, but I do want to talk about those performances a little bit. What are some of the performances that stuck out to you on a good or bad way?
Zendaya as Chani, I thought was really great. I feel like that character is a million miles different from the book, which could be a concern for people, but I think in the structure of the movie, it really works, and she really brings that to life.
That's a really crucial, like her role in the second part, especially. It's so crucial she hits those notes really well. Yeah, yeah. Because otherwise people might miss the point. And I'll tell you, I still worry watching this that some people might have missed the point of what's going on with Paul Atreides in this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've seen actual critics and commentators be like, I swear allegiance to Paul Atreides and I will join the jihad. And I'm like, oh, you did not understand this fucking movie. Well, and because I think, I don't want to get into this now, but let's just say the way that Chani functions because of other changes is really important. And I think she brings that to life. I really enjoyed Javier Bardem, even though his Stilgar is so fucking different from the book, and I'm not sure that all of it works like on the page, but the way that Bardem brings it to life, it's hard for me to care. I like him as that character, even if I don't like that character as much as the original character.
It's one of those situations where the actor makes the role, right? Because he 100%. He is so fun to watch on screen, and his commitment to what's going on is so high. Yeah, no, I think he's terrific in it. Sorry, you were going
to
ask?
I needed to find it. I just found it myself. Rebecca Ferguson, again, mm-hmm. Lady Jessica in this movie is not the Lady Jessica from the book, so there's a lot to sort of get from the script, and I think she does that. She really adds a sense of menace, right? Like, yes, sure. She cares for Paul, but she is not to be fucked with, and I think that was interesting. Of course, a lot of people have said this, so I don't need to say too much about it, but Austin Butler as Fade Ralpha. I mean, no offense to Sting. And you know, I think what you mentioned as an off comment is maybe a good argument to make, which is that the ending of this movie does not have the camp that the Lynch movie has at the end. And part of that in the Lynch movie is Sting's ridiculous performance, right? That being said, for this movie, it felt like they needed a more menacing version of Fade Rautha, and this dude fucking pulls it off. Like, he is a scary guy. And the last thing I really wanted to mention was Florence Pugh, because Princess Irulan in the book is not a character. There's no fucking character there.
Sure.
And she brings that to life. Even with the limited amount that she has, you believe in who she is, which is the child of this emperor, and you have less context. Like, even in the book, you don't get a lot of her personality, but you get a lot more context for who she is. Like, she's growing up with all this privilege, but her privilege is tempered by the fact that the emperor is a man of different moods, right?
Sure.
And so she writes in the book about how many times her sisters and her mom have had to avoid assassins because their dad was just mad, so he sent an assassin to murder them. And they always get out of it, right? But it's just part of their life that sometimes dad wants them dead, and then when it doesn't work, he's like, okay, well, that's fine. You know, and so, like, that's not in the movie. You can't put that in the movie. It's too distracting. It's such a weird detail. It's not going to work. So she has to give you the strength of that character in a way that you understand in the book. She must be pretty strong because she's had to fight for her life her whole life.
Sure.
But there's the context isn't there. So I really appreciated that as well. In fact, if we're just going to say, like, I don't know that anything really stood out to me as a poor performance or a poor casting. Other than, like I said, I don't know that Christopher Walken works in that role, even though I love him. And I think he nails that moment of menace. But I think a younger guy could have pulled off the idea that, like, until he shows his true face, the emperor is not menacing, right? He's hiding his menace.
Sure.
In fact, in the book, a whole big part of the plot is the lengths he's willing to go to hide his menace. That's partly why all this is happening. And yet in the movie, he does just seem kind of old and not fully there. And yes, that moment kind of reveals the lie of that, but I think it doesn't work for the whole film for me. And so, you know,
it's still a powerful moment when he bends the knee, for sure, right?
100%.
And I think that's, as long as that works, then that character really does work. I will say that when it comes to the comparison of the Austin Butler character compared to how Sting is treated in the David Lynch Doom, I still find, like, just the conceit that everything that happens in these two movies and in that movie ends up with a one-on-one fight between two characters is so ludicrous already that in some ways I do lean towards the more campy version of it, because it's like, all right, the universe is up for, whoever wins gets control of the entire universe right now. And it's just, you know, a guy in his underwear and Kyle MacLachlan, right? But I do think that because of how they set up Austin Butler's character here and his viciousness and his sadism, that it really does come off as being impactful. However, because of that, because they've set him up as a sadist like that, it's hard not to watch it and think, oh, this is a good guy, Paul Atreides, versus a bad guy, as opposed to a really, really bad guy, and a guy who's kind of leaning towards maybe being a piece of shit himself. So it's hard, like, please.
No, I think that's all entirely right, Doug, and I think that that is the point in the book, is that, you know, the quote, it gets quoted too much, but this is the quote from Herbert, right, is the difference between a hero and an anti-hero is where you end the story. So the book is meant to climax in this ridiculous hero's fight so that you understand that as the tragedy moves forward, that why Paul feels like he's set up to be this hero, so that his fall is that much farther, right? Like, it's that's supposed to be the setup for it. And I don't know that everyone got it because they just take it so seriously. It's hard to mock something that is so ingrained into our psyche that we just go, yeah, of course he fights the guy. It's what a hero would do. And it's like, yeah, Herbert thinks that's dumb. That's why it's in the book. And so I think, I think the camp of the Lynch one really works. And honestly, that again is one of my defenses of the Lynch movie, that the silliness is part of the is baked in. It's part of the value.
Sure.
Right. Mm-hmm. It really, that part I think actually does reflect something in the book. And I think if you're going to criticize the Villeneuve movie from my perspective, one of the problems for me is that the ending is so serious and we don't get, you know, part, what is it? First is tragedy, then is farce, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I think Herbert very much sees part of the tragedy of what he's trying to tell you as related to a kind of dark humor, you know, and a thing that he's kind of caricaturing in a certain way. And I think that that is kind of lost in this movie, but it's hard to fully say it's lost because I don't think it would work in the movie, right? It would feel latched on, you know, and part of what makes that moment of them fighting Doug so ridiculous in the book is this idea that I said earlier of plans within plans. There are so many schemes at work and so many invested parties. I mean, one of the things to notice that is a change that maybe I think doesn't work is that this movie entirely eliminates the Spacing Guild. They talk about it. We need the spice for the Spacing Guild. But they are not characters, really. They are not players. It's not clear in the movie what Lynch makes it so that part of the reason any of this shit is happening is because of the Spacing Guild. Because the guild's like, you have to kill Paul Atreides. Which is not in the book, by the way. But it's a way for Lynch to signal that the guild is invested very strongly while still focusing on other characters. Because that's really clear in the book, that while the guild is not fully present, they're fucking invested. And part of the reason they're invested is because of various lies, right? One of those lies is what they say in the movie. Without spice, interstellar travel is impossible. That's not fucking true, actually. It's what the guild wants you to believe. Also, that the guild is invested in spice for interstellar travel. No, they use the spice, and spice allows them to kind of see the future, which is why they're really invested in Arrakis, because they don't trust the fact that they can't see past Arrakis. They know something's going to happen there. They don't know what it is, and they're fucking bummed, and they don't like feeling out of control. And so they're invested in what's happening there. It's a lot for the movie, man. You know, like, you know, it's a great, let me give you one great little microcosm of how things change in the movie, right? You brought up the black and white scene in the Colosseum, right? So in that scene, right, the Baron has set up Fade Rautha, right? And it's presented as either the Baron was trying to kill Fade Rautha, which I don't think we believe, or he's trying to test him. And then we see how crafty the Baron is, that he's willing to risk the life of his heir in order to test him and give him the gift of the loyalty of the people, right? In the book, Doug, that's not what happened. In the book, Fade Rautha set this shit up because it seems for the positive attention, but then the big reveal is that it's so he could get the slave master killed so he would be blamed. He replaces the slave master with his own person, and then they send a slave to try to kill the Baron. It's too many layers. You can't do that in the movie. It's too many fucking layers. But that's sort of what the whole movie does, is that it takes what is a 7-layer thing that Herbert does in the book and simplifies it, which I think is good, but it does create some problems. One problem is, in this sequel, if we're going to get it, how are we going to do it with Chani? How does he have two children with Chani if Chani's the one person who doesn't believe in him? How does that happen, right? How do we handle in the book, it's really important that Paul doesn't follow the jihad totally. He leaves the path. He becomes a prophet in the desert and preaches against the Atreides while his sister rules. They're not going to do that in the movie. There's no fucking way. The sister's not even born yet. So how are they going to do that? You know what I mean? Like, there's just all these things that were changed. But I do want to say that while those changes could be criticized, they do something really important, Doug, which I think needs to be mentioned, which is this. Herbert doesn't have a lot of strong female characters, you know? It's one of two major problems in the book. The other one for me being the homophobia, you know? And what the movie does that the book does not do is take Chani and Jessica, who are prominent figures, but they're not very strong figures in the book.
Sure.
And makes them fucking essential. It builds them up. And same with Princess Irulan. Three characters. Three characters are taken from, you know, they're part of the story, but they don't have a strong sort of inner whatever that really moves us as readers. And in the movie, they're huge. They're huge figures. And while Jessica, in order to do that, she's a slightly different person, what she does works, because all those issues that she's bringing up around religion and prophecy and all that stuff, that's all in Paul's fucking head. That doesn't work in a movie, right? All the issues around politics and religion and all that stuff, that's all in Paul's head. No one's saying that out loud to him, right? That doesn't work. You need the mom there to bring that in. But I do think it complicates things, and it does put us in a place where when we get to that ending, Doug, in the book, it is ridiculous that all these schemes and all this shit over thousands of years, here it is, just a knife fight could ruin the whole thing. A goddamn knife fight. And Paul knows it. And you get the feeling that Paul chooses the knife fight because this is maybe the one way he can get out of this thing. But also, he still wins the knife fight because at his heart, I think, he actually isn't sure that he doesn't want to be the Maudeeb. That there's no fate. There's no supernatural fate. The fate is in who he is as a person. He's destined to be the Maudeeb because he's a privileged child with amazing powers who thinks that his abilities might make it worth it for him to rule the world, or the universe, rather.
Now that internal conflict does not come through in the movie at all.
A little, it does a little bit, because he does talk about his visions and he's scared of his visions. And in the
our outline a little bit. Yeah, right. He yells at his mom. It does feel like when he has the worm juice, the water from the worm, and almost dies, that basically tilts him, right? It tilts him towards his fate as a messiah type figure, where he doesn't like question it as much anymore.
I think that is also a big change, because in the book, there is a feeling he has that though he does fully lean into it, he has an insight that maybe he can still change it. And he actually gives, because in the book he has a child at this point, like time has really moved forward.
Sure.
And when he finds out that the child is dead is when he stops trying to fight the way.
Interesting.
Yeah. Because he kind of dies a little bit inside, you know, and he's not sure that anything is worth hoping in anymore, you know?
We didn't mention it, by the way. I think Timothée Chalamet does a really good job in these movies.
And I think it's a hard role, but I agree with you. I think he does do a good job.
The harder parts for him specifically, I think, come in the second movie, where he has to be the leader of a large group. And he still, to me, looks like a doughy-eyed teenager, right? But he brings something to those scenes that makes it believable that he could be the leader of a group, which I think is really tough. I think it's a really hard thing to ask of a young actor like that. And I think he does, at the very least, he's not distracting in any way, in the way that some people might think someone who is as slight as him might be in a messiah type role. How do you think the sandworms were handled, especially when you compare them to the David Lynch movie?
I think it's cool. I mean, I think it's easy to focus on the worms, you know, and get really, you know, tied up in them. But I think the worms, they looked cool, and I liked the way that they were done. I don't think they're as essential as other people seem to think.
I saw a lot of people after the first movie there were like, oh, I really wanted to see more of those worms. And now they got all bunch of worms in this.
Let's just say that the climactic end fight, which is, again, is slightly different than the book in some ways, but it doesn't matter. It's great. It works. It's a lot of exciting. It builds. It's really what it's been building up to. You could argue that maybe it's too great. It's a bit distracting, you know, from maybe other things going on. But I don't think so. I think in the
real problem with this movie, it's too great.
I mean, because in the sense that like the battle isn't really the point. The real point is the fight.
Yeah.
But I'm saying that as just to honor that could be a perspective for me as a film watcher. Show me the fucking worms, man. Like I want that idea. I want that to happen. You know, I think it does what it needs to do, and this is hard to believe because it's so huge. It's on a smaller scale, right?
Right.
There is more things going on that it could show, but that again would distract. So on this smaller scale, to pull off this epic, you know, the worms are breaking through the fucking wall, and you see the they're fighting in the sand and all this shit. I just think it really is pretty effective for what it is, and really gets us invested in something where, comparatively to other movies of this scale, it has a lot less CGI than it could. Right? Like, yes, you got the CGI storm and the sandworms, but there's a lot of like tight in shots of real people doing real things that other movies have avoided at all costs.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, absolutely, right? And even the physicality of the costumes and things like that. I still wonder, actually, if the thumper things that they use to call the worms, if those are CG or not. But the very fact that I wonder that makes it, I think, a pretty cool prop in and of itself. Do you think it's... I mean, this movie seems like it's a pretty big financial success. Mm-hmm. I mean, they say Denis Villeneuve pulled it off, right? I mean, he managed to make a financially successful adaptation of the first book of Dune. Can you see a future where another movie continues with that success? And is that reliant on Denis Villeneuve coming back to direct it?
Yeah, I think if they go with anyone else, it's a mistake. Like, even if you don't love his style or his direction, I think you got to admit that switching gears to a different director is really messing with the formula, because how are they gonna execute the sort of vision that he has been able to do? And I think from what he said, at least, he is committed to the books. I can say that I'm not sure all the changes worked, but overall, the movie, I think, does conform to the book a good deal. I think you're right that maybe it doesn't quite nail the conflict as solidly as it could. I think if he does another movie, though, and he bases it on the next book, I mean, the thing, sort of infamously, and this detail I only know a little bit, so if people know more about it, but my understanding is that while Herbert always intended a trilogy, the intensity of the second book is partly influenced by his feeling that people didn't understand the first book.
Right.
So I think it's very unlikely that people could get through a second movie based on the second book and be like, I don't know, Paul seems pretty cool. I mean, I think it becomes clear pretty quickly that shit is not cool. Right, that we are observing a tragedy, not a fucking heroic whatever. And so, like, is the studio going to stick to that? Right, even if they're making this money with him and they trust his style and they trust the cast, are they going to see the finished product of a movie based on that book and go, "Ooh, I don't know about this, guys. I don't know if this is a good idea." You know, especially because I think Villeneuve, you know, he's hitting it's something we didn't mention, but I think it is worth mentioning. He's actually hitting the religion point a little harder than Herbert does, even, right? Mm. For Herbert, it's religion, but it's also politics and economics and power. And Villeneuve, it's a lot more the religion aspect is something to be criticized. You know, I haven't seen any Jesus people upset about this, but, you know, if he goes to the story in the second movie, are there going to be Jesus people going, I don't know about this, this seems bad, you know? Like,
I mean, my interpretation watching this was like, this is like a story of Jesus, except Judas was right the whole time.
Right, exactly. Yeah, no, 100%. I mean, again, it's kind of similar to that, only I think that there's no indication from Paul that he thinks his own sacrifice is necessary per se. He's kind of trying to avoid that, I think, a good deal. But No. I think that's fair. Like that, you know, there's a built-in criticism that a messiah, a hero, a one person to solve all the stuff is probably a bad idea, right? It's probably, but also just an idea about power, right? That religious power, political power, economic power, they're actually all pieces of a puzzle and they can supplant each other, right? Like the houses have all this economic power, but the Emperor has the Sardaukar, right? And so no matter how much money all the other houses have, he can just send the Sardaukar and then it's over. But if the other houses get mad he did that, then they all rebel, then he doesn't have any money, then the Sardaukar don't matter. You see what I'm saying? Like, you kind of need all these things. You need the belief, you need the money, and you need the violence. Yeah. And Herbert really is dissecting that. I think this movie kind of focuses almost exclusively on the belief aspect, but I don't think it's less effective at doing that. In fact, in some ways, it might be more effective for the audience who's really able to connect with that criticism directly, especially in our current time period. Whereas if we were also thinking about the economics of the spice and the political power involved, yeah, it might get distracting. We might be like, well, there's a lot for me to think about here.
I do think the politics comes through with the Bene Gesserit stuff, where they're playing both sides and things like that. So at least it does touch on that. It does feel like if they are making a television show that's going to delve into that, that it could be a lot more political and play in that world a little bit. But I think you're right. I mean, I think there's only so much that you can do to reflect on current society in this movie. And when you're already dealing with the concern that people might not even understand that your main character is going through a sort of a crisis that you're supposed to be recognizing isn't necessarily going in a positive direction. Yeah. I mean, I think it comes through. I think it does not take a particularly observant viewer to notice what's going on in this movie. Yeah. It's helpful that you have Zendaya as someone who is such a sympathetic character that you see her, the world, and what's going on. In fact, it really does shift position in terms of main characters to making her kind of front and center by the time we get to the end.
Agreed.
I think that's really powerful. So I think that works really well. Any other thoughts on Dune Part 2, Liam?
I mean, like I said, I think that most of the changes worked. I really like the respect shown to women in it. I think one of the questions that we didn't get to, but it's worth thinking about, is how does this actually deal with Orientalism?
Sure.
I mean, you could point out we're 10,000 years in the future, and the native people who we're seeing as, you know, the native people of Arrakis are also colonizers. Everyone is colonizers. In Herbert's world, there are no aliens. There are only humans. And every planet just doesn't remember that they used to be on Earth, right? No one remembers Earth anymore, but that's where we're all from. So it's a little hard to get too much into the racialized aspect of
I think sometimes the music doesn't help, right? The music sometimes can
exactly,
be a little.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I think that was part of what was inspiring to Herbert, is to think about the ways that deserts formed populations and culture. And if you are more knowledgeable about both language and religion, when you read the book, you'll notice he didn't just borrow from Arabic cultures. He actually borrowed from other cultures that live around or in deserts. But a lot of people didn't get that because there's a lot of Arabic specifically. And one of the things that we don't talk about a lot is that Herbert was an amateur linguist. And in fact, linguists have commented on how good his language work is in the all six books, that he creates words that are actually amalgamations of various languages. And it's really well done. So that's part of what's going on there. In a movie, though, what's interesting in a desert? You're going to show a bunch of folks who look like they might be either Arabic or Bedouin or other sort of identified with one region. And that can feel a bit Orientalist, especially when a lot of these actors are white folks. And that's another question, is like, does this movie work with all these white people in it? Though, to be fair, you know, Oscar Isaac, he's spicy white, right? Like, he's Cuban, you know what I mean? You know, our guy, our man, Aquaman, he's not technically white. He's Hawaiian, and I thought he was part Maori too.
Oh, he's part Maori as well. He has all these tattoos.
Yeah. So I think there are folks here adding a little bit of whatever, but
and we have Javier Bardem, of course. But
of course,
I don't think we should count it. I mean, and it's also not. I don't think it's helpful to compare how white the David Lynch movie is.
Oh, no.
Comparatively.
Ridiculous. Yeah. But I think that the question of Orientalism just gets complicated a little bit, because what was Herbert's intention and then what is the effect? I think the intention was not for that, but it's hard for a white dude writing a book in the 60s who isn't particularly a sensitive guy to those sorts of issues. It's there a little bit. But I think Villeneuve does a good job of not focusing on it so much that it becomes utterly distracting. But I get why people who are not paying enough attention have been like, it's a white savior movie. Well, I get your concern, guys, but Paul's not a savior, actually. So if it was meant to be a quote unquote white savior, then it would be a criticism of white saviors, because he fucking sucks.
I think that there's lots of very legitimate criticisms based on the Orientalism and the simplification, especially because some of these characters, because these characters are, you know, a lot of them are defined by their faith in Paul, that it becomes very religious coded. And you see a lot of, you know, visuals that connect with specific religions and specific religious acts. And I think that that's a very valid criticism and not one that I'm going to dive into because I don't feel qualified to. But I, yeah, if you think this is a white savior movie, you are missing really the biggest point.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's worth saying, too, that the movie, I think this is just another sort of problem with something that needs to be a little bit shorter because it can't reflect all the complexity to understand, you know, how these things kind of work and are complicated by the way Herbert is interpreting culture and power, right?
Right.
And so part of the point is that the Fremen are you can characterize them as strong because of their existence in the desert and as superstitious. But like all the cultures are superstitious, their superstition is just adapted to their circumstances. And all the cultures are cruel, right? Like there's all, you know, Paul is continually horrified when he first gets there of all the cruelties of the Fremen, whether it's getting the water from the dead bodies or there's all this toughness, right? But if you're paying attention to his world, everything is about poison and assassins. Like he can't touch anything without poison things. Normal people can't touch him because he's worried about getting assassinated all the time. So like technically speaking, the soft cushion life of the royalty also dangerous and hard, right?
Yeah.
Like in this world, power is hurting everyone as much as it helps them. And so you just can't get that in the fucking movie. That there's too much detail there. But I do think that in a visual culture, I do wonder if maybe Villeneuve hit that in, because he didn't want to be accused, I think, of being too white with it.
Sure.
He hit that note a little too hard. And I think it comes across the Fremen aren't meant to be one culture, right?
Yeah.
The religion that goes there, you know, 6,000 years earlier are called Zensuni because in this future, Buddhism and Islam are basically the same thing.
Right.
And they've taken over half the planet and sent colonizers out to the universe. Right. So, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah. It also, there would be a different issue if all the Fremen were played by people of color or maybe Saudi actors or something like that. Yes. Right? I mean, that causes a whole other issue.
100%. 100%.
Liam, I think we're going to end it there.
I do. Sorry to be such a nerd, everyone.
No, I think the nerdiness is essential to this, particularly because it gives us some context in regards to what was left out of the movie and what could potentially be looked into in the sequels or television shows or whatever. I mean, look, we're going to listen to this podcast. We're not. But if we were going to listen to it 5 years from now, we're going to be like, I can't believe we ever liked Dune.
I mean, that is actually entirely possible. But right now, I really do like it.
it's the excitement of being at the start of something as opposed to being at the end of it. Liam, if people want to check out some other great podcasts or even our other episode of Cinema Smorgasbord Sells Out, what's the best way for them to do so?
Well, they can head over to cinepunks.com, that's CINEPUNX, for not only the latest episodes of this podcast, but a whole family of podcasts, a bunch of things over there. Recently, our friends over at Twitch of the Death Nerve released an episode on Sallow or 100 Days of Sodom, or 120 Days of Sodom, is that right?
120, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And really made a discussion not only of Pasolini and his work, but of politics and fascism and more current genocides occurring right now.
Speaking of works that have been horrifically misinterpreted by people over the years.
100%. And a bunch of other shows as well. I don't want to just say them, but I really like that episode, so I think people should check it out. If they want to dive into the archive, I mean, to be fair, there's not much of an archive of you know, Cinema Smorgasbord Sells Out. It's two episodes. But we have done a lot of other shows, Doug, with a lot of other episodes. And in our archive, you can search not just everything we've done, but by topic. If you only want to listen to Carol Kane, Praising Kane. If you only want to listen to the director-focused one where we talked about John Singleton. If you only want to hear us talk about Alejandro Jodorowsky, you can search for those specific topics or just go through the whole history, however you feel about it. If they want to see us on social media, Cinema Smorgasbord is specifically on X at Cinema Smorg, and Cinepunks is on all of the Johns at Cinepunks, CINEPONX. I will say, I forget to update us on X regularly, so apologies to everyone who still uses X, but we try to update our other profiles as much as we can.
You can find me over at Blue Sky. Just do a search for Doug Tilley. That's T-I-L-L-E-Y. And if you want to do a search for Cinema Smorgasbord on Facebook, we're on there as well. And if you enjoy what you're listening to, why don't you tell a friend? Why don't you leave us a review on your podcast provider of choice? Every little bit helps. It helps us stay ad-free. Not that anyone was offering us ads in the first place. But it does help to keep the show free for all. Liam, I think it's time for us to take a little break. We're going to be back soon with another opportunity to sell out. Good night, everyone.
Night night. We'll be right back.